I hands down think that's our best intro. It just makes you want to start teaching, actually. It just feels epic. But has anybody, I'm curious, any readers out there? Okay, good. We have a church full of some readers. That's great. Now, here's the big question, though. Who are the people in the room that reads the prologue? I'm shocked by that. I'm shocked by that. Because I surveyed all my class. I've surveyed a lot of people. Prologues are always skipped because you just want to get to the story. I bring that up to say, I don't know if you've been tracking with us, but we're going through Genesis. We've made it through chapter 4. We're going to enter a new section of what many people call the prologue of the Bible. And what I mean by that is chapters 1 through the end of 11 are really the prologue. And what is a prologue? A prologue is the part of the story that sets up what you're about to read. It's setting up the story, the things you'll interact with, why the author has written it. It's to help you make sense of what you're about to read. So hear me, don't skip the prologue. And it sounds like I don't really have to tell you all that because y'all do it. Here's why. What I want you to see and what my goal is as we talk through this section of the story is that you will actually see a mini narrative of the whole body of Scripture. What we're going to talk about today is the story of Noah. And many of us are familiar with that story, even in kids' ministry, right? Like, what's one of the most common picture books out there for kids? It's Noah and the Ark, right? It's one that we're familiar with, but if we're honest, one that we also really struggle with, right? And so what we're going to do is we're going to try, disclaimer, please, we're going to try to cover chapter 6 through 9. So stick with me. We're going to do our best to cover the big themes and what we need to get out of this story and do it justice. Because what I want you to see, like a prologue, the very story of your Bible that it will unfold is all found in what we've been talking about from Genesis 1 to what we're going to end with today at the end of Noah getting off the boat, right? And so that's what I want to set us up for, is as we look at this story, you're going to see this grand narrative being unwound for all of us if we have the eyes to see it. And so that's my goal for us today. So if you have a Bible, and I hope you do, turn to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6. Last week, Will taught on Cain and Abel, which was really what happened to this family of image bearers after sin entered the world, right? What happened to the family as they exited the Garden of Eden, and we saw the tragedy that unfolded with these two brothers. Well, now, we're basically going to zoom forward in time after these generations have expanded, multiple generations are now on the earth. And in Genesis chapter 6, read with me in verse 1, when man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit will not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterwards, when the sons of God came to the daughters of woman and man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. And the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intention of the thought of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved God to his heart. And so the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, the first thing I want us to see, because there's a lot to unpack, is really the idea of when you look at the world today, right, we hope that good wins, right? All the movies we love, all the things that we love is we hope that the good guys win in the end. We hope that good flourishes, and that is what God created. If you remember Genesis 1, what did he say at the end of creation? He saw all things, and it was good. Good is flourishing, right? Will talked about this, that this word is the idea of the flourishing of life, right? When God created things, we see the goodness of God flourishing. We see that happen, but very quickly into the story, we know what happens also as we've unpacked this, is that people became agents of chaos. And at the same time, oftentimes in our world, where we hope that good wins, we know that oftentimes it doesn't always seem to prevail, or it takes forever for it to find justice. And the issue with this, guys, is that we often think that that's a unique problem and that we're not part of the problem. That we look and go, whenever good doesn't win, it's unique. But the Bible is going to say something in the story and say, no, it's actually very common. And if we're honest with ourselves, we agree with that too. And I'll get to what we mean by that. Right? We often think that we're good compared to these other things, or these other people. But remember, comparison was never about, when we're defining good, it was never about you looking at other people to define what was good. What was good in Genesis? That which God had made in his design to bring the flourishing of life. So the standard of good, the standard of that which flourishes, was always God. And so when we look at our lives and we go, well, it's a unique problem out there, it's not. Because the standard was never others and you outweighing them. The standard was always, do you measure up to what God's standard was for you? And that was his image. Remember the beauty of it that we said in second week in chapter 2, that the image of God is the one that got to personally reflect and relate to God himself. The grand pinnacle of creation, that was the standard, not others. Another way that we see this, just to give you an example, my students oftentimes in school, they wonder, it's very hard as a teacher, as I'm learning as a second year teacher, to keep my cool in these moments. But a student will come up to me often when they'll get like a 98 or something like that, right? And they'll go, why didn't I get 100, Mr. G? Well, here are the comments I laid out in this paper of why you didn't achieve that. It's just 2 points. You did a great job. No, you don't understand. How did I make this, but they made this? You see what happens? They wanted to know why they didn't make a grade when they know the person that they thought did a worse job made a different grade. And what's the reality? Why didn't you make 100? Because it wasn't based on what they did on the paper, it's what the instructions for the paper were. You didn't get this grade because you didn't produce the desired outcome of what the paper intended. I don't give you grades based on what other students do. I give you the grade based on what the standard was, right? And so what we're going to see in this story and what we kind of just read is we're going to see a bunch of humans that multiply imperfection and sin, which will lead to devastating results. So the first point I want us to see is that humans are on the path towards decreation. And we'll unpack what that means, but humans are on the path in the story towards decreation. The humans that we saw in the garden that were expelled because of sin and that we saw two brothers murder one another, they will multiply. If you looked at verse 1, it says they began to multiply. Hear me. Is that not what God told them to do, though? It is. Remember, he told Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply over the face of the earth. They're doing it. But notice the small caveat that the author puts in there. It says when they multiplied, look at verse 5, he also saw that the wickedness of man was multiplying on the earth, right? So what we need to see here is when God said in Genesis 1, what did he see? Good. It's the word tov, right? It's where we get the words for the knowledge of good and evil, the tree. You remember what Will had taught, that the tree wasn't just about taking knowledge and having knowledge. It was defining it apart from God. You taking this fruit and saying, I will now define what good and bad are. Or I could have learned from God and walked in the flourishing of life, but they didn't. See, when God ends Genesis 1, he sees everything is tov. It's good. It's flourishing. But when God looks 6 chapters later down, does he look at the world and see tov and good flourishing? It says he saw, it's the same word for the tree. He sees raw, bad. The words here that you see, wickedness and evil, it's just the same word. What they did is they took from the tree, they defined good and evil for themselves, and all that was produced from it was the bad. So when God looks down now, there's no longer tov, good. It's multiplied bad. So humans have taken and defined what they believed would bring them life, and it has brought these disastrous consequences because they have defined it apart from what God had done already. So, and we understand this too. We see such potential in humans, right? Look at the flourishing that societies have had. Look at the ways that humans are able to create such unique things. We see this beauty in there, but underlying this reality is violence, imperfection, waywardness, often in every society. How do I know that? Because hear me, have you ever heard the phrase, well, I'm only human? How come that's not a positive? How come we're not saying I'm only human? And it's like, so I'm a really great person. We use this common denominator phrase, I'm only human, to say what about ourselves? I'm flawed just like humans. We understand it intrinsically, even though we have the potential for flourishing, the common denominator for us, even in our phrases, is, I'm gonna mess up. We understand and see it, right? The potential for life is often overlaid, though, with the truthfulness of failure. Okay, but notice also, what I'm going to get at here is we see humans are multiplying evil, but there's also this new player too, right? It says the sons of God saw the daughters of man and were attracted, and they took for their wives any they chose. Okay, so not to get and unpack this because we got to move, but basically these new players on the scene are this idea of there's this now not just human rebellion, but cosmic rebellion happening is all that's happening. And what I want you to focus on in this text is what I'm trying to get across with the multiplying of bad. Notice what it says about the sons of God. What does it say that they saw? Look at the phrasing of the verbs. It says the sons of men saw that something looked good, and they took. You're supposed to pick up on something. That language was used somewhere else already in the Bible. It was just two chapters ago when Eve saw that the tree was good and it looked attractive and gave delight. And what does she do? And she took and gave. What we see here is this cosmic rebellion happening. We had humans fall in the garden, and now as they've multiplied, guess what is still happening? They are defining life for themselves of what they think will be good. And it always is just the multiplication of bad. Even if it looks good on first, it will never bring the flourishing that God desired because it's not how he defined it to be. That's what's happening here. And so what I want you to see, application for us guys, is oftentimes our biggest struggles is this, that we see something that we think will bring us life apart from how God designed it or defined it. And when we go after these things that we think will bring us life, they often bring ruin. And we understand this with our children, right? They see something that they think will bring them life apart from your rules. And what almost always happens? It brings devastating results. For instance, our kid's Ben. He is awesome. He's a great kid. He's fun. He's loving. He's jokester. He's awesome. But he loves balls. And one of our rules was, hey, let's not throw this around the house. But let's be real. It's fun to throw it around the house. It looks like it's going to bring life and good and joy. But guess what happens as he continues to throw it and not listen? We have another son named Reed who watches this. That does look like life. That does look good. And he doesn't find a ball he can carry because Ben's throwing this bigger one. So Reed has to find one that can fit in his hand. And what do we have that fits in his hand? Golf balls. And so you know where I'm going as you all made that sigh. The thing that they thought would bring life is about to bring devastating results, right? The rules were not put there to constrict their freedom. The rules were actually put there to allow for good and true flourishing of freedom. I use this example all the time with my students. Anybody love dodgeball when they were in high school? Okay, it's one of my favorite games too. It still is. But have you ever had the coach walk out when you were playing? Anyone ever have that happen? Okay, that's it. I knew someone would appreciate it. It becomes a free-for-all. And it's fun for a few seconds. And then what happens? Nobody gets out. It's a free-for-all. There's no rules anymore. See, the rules were put in place, this defining of flourishing. Why? So the game's actually fun. Right? And what we see humans doing is going, hey, I think this will bring life. I think this will be good. And it's just multiplying devastating results. Right? And so this is what happens with people. We get stuck in what we think will bring life, like pornography, addictions, anger, all these different decisions that in the moment seem so right, but they wind up always bringing some form of, hear me, decreation. Decreation. What do I mean by that? Decreation is the idea that when God created, he ordered it in this beautiful, flourishing way. In decreation, what we're going to see happen in this story is God's basically going to take his hands off the order. You want to rule apart from me, I am giving you that value and that choice. But when I take my hands off, creation will collapse on itself. And we'll get to that. But we understand this too, just to reiterate this last point, because I think this is an area we struggle with, is were people really that bad, and what is God's response? And we'll get to that. But I hear this phrase all the time back home. The world is going to hell in a handbasket, right? And what are we saying by that? We see that in the political sphere. We see that whenever there's something bad that happens in your city. And what are we saying? It's our phrase to define what we see as decreation. We look at the world and go, that's not how it should be. The order is off, and it looks like it's collapsing on itself, right? We're saying society looks like it's collapsing when we say these phrases. It's idioms we use still to define this real thing that's happening. And so things need to be fixed. What we see here is that as humans multiplied, sin has become so encased in who we are that it's multiplied and it has led to corruption and wickedness all over the land, is what it says. And so I want to give you this example as we're going to move into what God then does. How would you feel? I'm curious. If you built a business from scratch, anyone do that in here? Okay, you've built a business from scratch. Think about it. You built it, all the hard work you've put into that, all the time, the effort, the energy, and it starts flourishing. It's great. You see it helping the community. The community is excited about your business. People are generally thrilled with what you've produced, right? It's a life-giving entity. And then after a while, you've created this partner to come alongside you that's excited. They're amazing. They're talented. They have all the resources they need to do this. And you give the reins over as you kind of watch over too. And as you do this, this person does well. But then after a while, you return. And you see not only is the business that brought joy once failing, but the community is being harmed by it. There's money laundering happening through it. There's atrocities that they're kind of hiding. It's extorting. It's stealing from people that it once loved. I'm just curious for you in the room, how would you feel in that moment from the business you created, seeing all that? Angry. What would you do with your partner? You get rid of them, right? You're angry. You're ready to just kick them out. Like, I can't believe you let this happen. Okay, so let me throw this in there. Just a little twist. What if it was your child? What if the partner was your child? But does it change it in your head a little bit? It's no longer just about getting rid of them, but there's a little bit of pain in it. There's a little bit of grief, like, it's not just a partner that I can just throw to the curb. This is a child that justice still has to be met. But we still feel a little bit. And I want us to see this, especially as we're about to see God's view here. Right? What will God do when we see this multiplication and humans on the path towards decreation? And the first thing I want us to see here is that God cares about the injustice from generation to generation. God cares about it. God is not going to just look at it and go, look, it's okay, right? It's not. But there's a side of things that we miss in this flood narrative because we're so stuck on justice, which is a good thing. And so look at this in verse 5 and 6. The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. See, I love this. God doesn't look from afar going, man, look at those screw-ups. It's grief. That's the word here. The word here is literally, in the tense for the Hebrew, it's he had to comfort himself, is the idea here. Right? That's the way it's described. He had to comfort himself because there is nothing to comfort God in what he sees. There's nothing he looks at and goes, there's life there. right? So he has to create a solution through grace that is going to be both just and have mercy in it, right? And this is important. Why? Because, hear me, you may have heard, and it's true, there are other ancient Near East flood accounts. There's a ton of them, actually. Maybe you've heard one like Gilgamesh and stuff like that. When you go read the flood narratives, you'll be shocked at why those gods send the flood. Most of the time, it's because humans are pests. Like, literally, the Epic of Gilgamesh, if you've ever read it, it's because humans were being too noisy. And so he woke the god from the slumber, and he wants to bring a flood. I bring this up to say, we often have struggle with the flood narrative because why would God do this? Why would God wipe out? Look at what's describing of why the flood's coming, though. This is important. God sees both the justice that needs to happen, but there's grief because there's no comfort to be found. There is real grief in what's about to happen. He looks down at the ones who he calls his image bearers. He looks at what they have multiplied, and he has to have a solution, and that solution that's going to have to deal with this problem is going to be just and merciful. God is grieved by what he sees. It is not an act of vengeance on the humans. It is not an act of disappointment. It is an act of grief. And the word here is the idea of there is a pain I see that causes me to respond. I need you to see this because of what's going to happen. The flood, so why the flood? Catch this. What did God, again, create in chapter 1? We always miss this. Chapter 1, verse 2, it says, and the Spirit was hovering over the faces of the what? Catch this. What God did in chapter 1 is he brought order to the chaos waters to bring flourishing of life. Why the flood? God is going to remove his hands, and the flood waters that he has put in order are going to collapse back on creation. The chaos waters that the Spirit hovered over and brought order to in the flood, it's basically God saying, I'm removing my order that I've held up. You want to go that way. This is the end result, decreation. Okay? And so we see this throughout the Bible, in case you're like, Cole, you're going off the rails here. So in Deuteronomy 31, it says this. Hopefully it'll be on the screen. Yes. The Lord said to Moses, this was when Israel was about to go into the land of Canaan. The Lord said to Moses, you're about to rest with your ancestors, and these people will soon prostitute themselves with the foreign gods of the land that they are entering. Right? They'll go away from God. They will abandon me, break covenant I have made with them. Sounds very similar in the language. My anger will burn against them on that day. I will abandon them, hide my face from them, so that they will become easy prey. Many troubles and afflictions will come on them. On that day, they will say, haven't these troubles come to us because our God is no longer with us? I will certainly hide my face on that day because of all the evil that they had done by turning to other gods. What he's saying is, hey, fine. You want the other gods. You can have them. But what that means is I'm going to step back the reins of my order, and you can experience what that's like to really walk away from me. If you want to step outside these bounds, go. But decreation will happen. Why? Because I'm the one that created and holds it together. You go after the foreign gods, you can have them. But it will only lead to death and destruction. Paul takes this up in Romans chapter 1 where he says they exchange gods for images of relating to mortal men and creeping things. And he says, and God gave them over to their lusts. What he's saying is, what does the wrath of God look like? He says, I'm giving them up to what they want. And that means apart from me. And when you walk away from the very source of life itself, what is the inevitable reality that happens? Decreation, death, ruin. Okay? So what we see here by Daniel Hawk, it's very helpful. We are left with the sense that God is not so much sending the flood to punish the world as much as facilitating through the flood the inevitable descent into chaos caused by human destructiveness and violence. Hear me. God ruins an already ruined creation, and in doing, creates conditions for a reordering and a renewal to take place. See the justice and the mercy that's going to come. The justice is you will go your own way. And you will see the results of it. But there's hope in the midst of this that I will set it up also for a renewal to bring about because of what's happened. So the flood is not just an act of justice, but also grace to see I've enacted a plan to preserve. Right? The flood is going to come from both heavens and earth. Right? It's going to say the waters from the deep and the waters from above. right? It's a idea, hear me, almost like a decreation of a heaven and an earth where you would have to now restart a new heaven and new earth. Second Peter will pick up on this language where he talks about when Christ returns, there will be a new creation, a new heavens and new earth, and not this time with flood water, but with fire. So what we see being done here is God is patient in seeing chaos expand, but don't take that as an acceptance. What we ruin, God will ruin. So it is not capricious, it's not random, it's not vengeful, it's just, and it's ready to preserve in mercy. Okay? So, take a breath. Ready to go on to the next chapters? All right. So, what's the big thing? So, what we see here is that we see why the flood. We see multiplication of chaos and ruin. We see God's response and why the flood there. Because he's letting humans go their way. Decreation will set in because of that. And so, God enacts a plan to say, hey, I will preserve even though you've gone that way. And so, what is his plan? I love this. Darren, do you have that graphic? Really random graphic. Okay, this is really random, so pick with me. The reason I'm going here, this is the whole flood narrative, okay? What Hebrews do is there's a thing called chiasm. It's where stories are structured to bring up one big main idea. So you have the heavenly rebellion, you have the rebellion of what Noah's sons will do. They all correspond with one another going towards the middle. That's what a chiasm is. It's these two ends that are building upon one another to meet a main point in the middle. So you'll see things like the flood begins, the flood will end. Noah enters the ark. Noah sends out birds to leave the ark. The flood overwhelms the land. The flood recedes from the land. It's the same language in these sections. I just show you that graphic to say as a Hebrew would look at this, it all pivoted on one section as the main idea. And are you ready for this? Chapter 8, verse 1 says this. But God remembered Noah. As well as the wildlife, the livestock that were there with them in the ark, God caused a wind to pass over the earth and the water began to subside. The point I want to get across here, guys, is we see why the flood, we see what humans have done, but we need to also see God is faithful to his promises. God is faithful to his covenants. Enter Noah. What's the big deal with Noah, right? Because that's what he's saying. God's preservation was through remembering his promises to this man named Noah. So what do we know about Noah? Well, in chapter 1, this might throw some people, but notice what it says about Noah. Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Favor is this idea of grace. It's where we get our term grace. Noah found grace. It's this word for I saw something that was delightful. I show and extend blessing to you, right? So God is extending blessing to this human named Noah, which is interesting. Do you know what Noah's name means? Comfort. The thing God could not find, Noah's name is. The chaos of the waters has a comforter. Remember Genesis 3 when Will had talked about the snake slayer? The chaos that we need one from the son of woman to crush the head of the snake? The idea is they've watched it multiply, but now we have one apparently that might bring comfort to the rebellion. And he's found God's grace. Why? What does he see here? In Noah. Notice what it says. It says, and Noah was blameless in verse 9 of chapter 6 in his generation and righteous. Noah walked with God. Where else do we see that language, walked with God? There's only two other places so far that we've read. Eden with Adam and Eve. Their original creation was to walk and learn from God in wisdom. Noah is a man like Adam that should have originally been. And then you would see it again with Enoch, very random thing in chapter 5 where Enoch walked with God and God took him. It's the idea of people that actually looked at God's wisdom, walked in it, and obeyed in righteousness and blamelessness, he says. And so, thing you need to see here is the potentials here. Is Noah the one? Is Noah the one that will crush the chaos? Is Noah the one that will bring comfort to our sin? Is Noah the one that will restart creation with and save? That's what's happening, right? And in Psalm 15, just to clarify this, what's the deal with the blameless and righteous? Psalm 15, verse 1 through 2 says this, Lord, who can dwell in your tent? Who can dwell with the Lord? Who can live on your holy mountain? Notice the language. The ones who live blamelessly and righteous and acknowledge the truth of heart. It's the same words for Noah. Why does Noah get to enter the ark Why is Noah's family chosen? God showed grace, and Noah responded in obedience. So what is the ark? What we're going to see is it's actually a makeshift temple, but we'll get there. Now, Noah was righteous in his generation. I want to hit on this very quickly because I see, 120 years from the building to the flood, faithfulness to the preserve. So we see Noah, his response. How do we see, why is he blameless and righteous? Well, think about this. We always miss this in the story. When you check chapter 6, Noah's not going to speak once at all. God will eventually say something about Noah in chapter 7, but what you need to see is God just tells Noah, build the ark. We may miss this. God doesn't actually tell Noah why. God does not tell Noah originally why he's going to flood the earth. He just says, build the boat. And he gives the details and all that. He doesn't tell Noah what he's about to do until he's about to put Noah in the ark. What you see is Noah having radical obedience to what God has said and goes, okay, I don't understand why I'm building a boat on dry land, but I'm going to do it because God's way is good. It brings life. It brings flourishing and preservation. And so Noah obeys even when he doesn't understand what's about to come. God does not give him the details until the obedience has already shown up. And so for 120 years, Noah's obedience is faithful in his generation. Hebrews is going to pick this up in chapter 11, verse 7, where it says, by faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, took heed and constructed an ark for the saving of his household. Noah's 120 years was a test of the blameless faith that he has. God has showed him grace, and Noah responded in obedience in his generation. So Noah is the one God is going to use to recreate humanity as one like Adam, as one that walked with him, and he's going to use this family to restart his image bearers to bring the flourishing of life. God did not give up on his plan. It was always, he saw this, and Noah's on the boat now to be preserved and to bring salvation, which is so interesting. Hopefully you're hearing the meta-narrative now. But Noah enters the ark. So as Noah goes on the ark, right, this blameless man preserved for all of mankind, the ark is this temple-like structure, these three tiers like the temple will have, where God will preserve mankind, where God's presence will be with his people. The ark, just to give you a little fun facts, the ark is the same word for the basket that Moses is going to be in the sea. You remember as a baby, he got put in the basket and he goes down the Red Sea? Catch the themes. A one who will lead God's people to salvation was put into this ark, preserved over the chaos waters, to be brought out to lead his people to salvation. And then what is the ark covered with, right? The ark is a representative of God preserving a faithful remnant, okay? And then what's it covered in? Pitch. That's the word there, right? And this word pitch in Hebrew, it's really weird because you would just think, it's just pitch. What's the big deal with pitch? It's where we get in Leviticus the word for ransom and atonement. This ark that will preserve the blameless one over the chaos waters is covered in atonement. Just interesting, right? We'll see where that pops up again. Just stick with me. So the point being, he has preserved Noah from the chaos to become the new person to recreate. Okay? And so what happens as the floodwaters come on the water? We have this blameless one in his generation, one that walked with God. And can I just give a little application because I know time's running? Is this. Generations are lost because of people failing to walk with the Lord. Look at who's preserved in Noah's line, his family. Generations are found from people giving an example of blamelessly walking with God in the grace that they've been given through Jesus. Man, you're walking with God. You're learning God's way. You're learning the wisdom of God through his word and walking in the Spirit. It's the same language to say, man, as we walk with God, we are the salt of the earth, the preservers. As we walk in obedience, we need more and more people going, I'm going to take God at his word. I'm going to listen so that I can bring a preservation to those that watch me. We got to start seeing ourselves as this new creation. So, what happens? He's on the boat, and then God remembers his promise. God is faithful. When things go so wrong, God is faithful. And so, as the water starts subsiding, catch the language here in verse 1 of chapter 8. And the wind blew over the earth and the water subsided. How did the waters in Genesis chapter 1 get order? What was hovering? It's the same word, ruach. God is recreating. He's taking the chaos that has happened because of humanity and is recreating to bring a preservation so that flourishing can happen again in a new creation. And so Noah is going to send out two birds, right? He's going to send out after 40 days. He opened the window of the ark that he had made. And in verse 7, sent forth a raven and went to and fro. The waters dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove to see if the waters had subsided under the face of the earth. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him in the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and drew her in. After 7 more days, he sent out the dove, and the dove came back in the evening. And behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that waters had subsided from the earth. He sends out these animals, right, these birds, to say, is it safe? Has new creation started? Is it safe to get off? Has God brought back order? Right? And so he goes off the boat. And what's the first thing he does in chapter 8? Look at verse 15. God says, go out of the ark, you and your wife, your sons and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you, all flesh, birds, animals, creeping things that creep on the earth, and they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply. Right? This new Adam. So Noah went out, and his sons and wives and his sons' daughters with him. And then Noah, in verse 20, built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Notice what God smelled. And God smelled the pleasing aroma. And the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. That word for pleasing aroma is the idea of comfort. It brought rest. So Noah, this blameless man, gets off the ark. He gives a sacrifice, right? We see that in the Levitical law, setting that up. He gives a sacrifice to the Lord in faith, and it actually brings rest to the chaos. And God goes, I will never again do what has happened here in the flood, right? And it's a beautiful thing. He smells this pleasing aroma, and Noah, in God's grace, has brought about a recreation. And what should we all hope if you're reading this for the first time? It's happened. The snake has been crushed. Chaos will never ensue again. But did you catch what God just said on the offering? I will never again curse the ground. Thanks. Awesome. That's what Noah did, right? But the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. Wait a minute. Who's on the boat? The blameless and righteous one. So who would have the evil heart? What I want you to see in this, guys, the author's already trying to give you, the solution is not as apparent as we had hoped. It doesn't start off so good. Notice, Noah will get off the boat, and there was wickedness, and the cycle will continue. Look at chapter 9. How interesting is this? Because my students have always asked me, good, we're on a perfect time. Yes. My students always ask me, Mr. G, why doesn't God just start over? Like, if you're really saying things are that bad and people sin, why doesn't God just start over? You ever asked that? He did. That's the flood. He is starting over with a blameless man and his family. Right? God has done that. The issue was sin was still crouching at the door. Look at chapter 9. And if you go down to verse 20, Noah gets off the ark, and Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. What did he plant? A garden. Interesting. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. And then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, walked backwards, covered the nakedness of the father. Their faces were turned backwards, so they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall be to his brothers." The story with Noah ends with another tragedy. Catch this. Remember when they left Eden, Adam and Eve? What was the next story? Cain and Abel, the sons. Noah gets off the ark. He's in a vineyard. It's the snake slayer. And now it's a story of siblings doing, specifically a son, doing something sinful that leads to chaos and separation of the family. The snake and sin were still there. And that's the point of the story, guys. We're gonna end on a good note, I promise. God, what we see over and over in humanity, I'm only human. We multiply bad because we define what we want and what we think will bring life, and it always leads to ruin. And God will give us what we want, and that is always going to be an act of decreation in our families, in our work life, in our life. Whatever it looks like, there will be chaos that will ensue because our sin separates us from God and walking in his wisdom and one another. And the pathway continues and continues. But remember what I said about a prologue? A prologue is not the story. It's to set up the story. Did you catch all the themes? There was a lot in there. But it's interesting. The last point I want us to see, because with this time, Christ is the ultimate fulfillment of bringing order to chaos and bringing humans through death and judgment. Christ, Jesus Christ, will be the one that actually fulfills what has been prologued all the way up till now. How so? If you looked, even his own ministry, you know how Christ defined it? Mark 10:45. "I came not to be served, but to serve, and give my life as a ransom for many," a covering. And then what else does Jesus do? He gets on the scene, and when he first starts his ministry, he goes to meet John the Baptist where? In a river, to be baptized. And notice what it says in Matthew 3, specifically verse 16. When Jesus was baptized, right, he goes down into the waters. And when he's brought up, the heavens suddenly open, and he saw the Spirit of God, descending like a dove and coming down on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved Son, whom I am well pleased." Remember what the dove represented in the ark? To showcase new creation has started. The Spirit falls on Christ to say, "Hey, the one who will start new creation and keep it has come." And how's he going to do it? He himself is going to become this ark that covers humanity and all those who will walk in obedience to come in the ark, that is covered with a ransom, this pitch. That as we go to Jesus, he will save us from the floodwaters that will come when he comes back, right? The judgment of God that is just, but those that trust in this blameless one who will not fail, who did triumph over the Satan in the wilderness, who did triumph on the cross, he says, get on the page here. Enter into Jesus. Put your faith in Jesus. Why? Because he's the man who has accomplished what no one else could. He's the one that brings us safely through the judgment and the wrath of God and the sin that has spread so much. He's the one who blamelessly and perfectly obeyed in our place because he was fully God and fully man. He is the one that says, you can come to God like Noah, blameless and righteous. Why? Because of his blameless and righteousness. So guess what you can now enter in? The tent and mountain of God. He has started new creation. That is why Paul will say, behold, the new has come. And who is he talking to? The church. It is through Jesus. Remember this point of Genesis. It's the pathway or the beginning of redemption. We see the narrative already there. And what we know as church is the fulfillment. So this is why Paul says, and I know that we have a room full of not really guests, but church people. Let me just put this out there. This is why Paul says today is the day of salvation. If you hear his call, please respond. Because there is a day when it will all happen again. Peter says, right, it'll come in fire. He's saying the ark is open to all. And his name is Jesus. we'll either walk and put our faith in his perfect obedience, or we will be ruined like the rest. So will you be part of the remnant, or will you be ruined? And the difference is simply this: not your work, but his. And your faith in that man. Let's pray. Father in heaven, I just come to you. And God, I know that that was a fire hydrant of content. And Lord, I just pray, Lord, in my weaknesses, in all that was said, that Lord, your spirit and your word would prove true, and that it wouldn't fall on deaf ears. That all of our hearts, myself included, would be amazed that one, God, you loved us that much. That God, when you saw the bad that was multiplying, you were grieved. You loved us. And Lord, your grace sustains us. And so Lord, help us, I pray, Jesus, be like Noah because of Jesus. Put our faith in you so that we would walk in the spirit you've given us, to be one that in our generation walked with God. So Lord, help us live this. Help us be a church that goes and tells people of the great salvation that our God has given us. In your name we pray.